what is ACOG and why are they warning people about bioidentical hormones? Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast. My name is James O'Hara, and today I'm joined by Dr. Dan Bristow, who is a OBGYN, and we're going to talk through hormones and some common women's health topics, some niche things that perhaps it's only me that find interesting, but I'm going to ask him anyway. So without further ado, Dr. Dan Bristow,
thanks for joining me. Thanks for having me.
So ACOG warns against bioidentical hormones. This is a headline from a couple of years ago, but it's gotten traction again. What is ACOG and why are they warning people about bioidentical hormones?
Yeah, good question. So ACOG is our governing body, American College of Obstetrician and Gynecology, really to bring in what I would say classic OBGYN thinks about hormones would be use the smallest amount for the smallest amount of time for the alleviation of symptoms.
Which is how we think about antibiotics.
Essentially,
except
yeah.
The symptom part, like you want to get rid of the infection.
Right. Right, you want to complete your entire antibiotics, folks.
Yeah.
But in terms of that, how we're trained is alleviation of symptoms is the main aspect. And so we classically think as something that is analogous to how the body makes it. So a bioidentical would be the best formulation. But ACOG has really taken more of the conservative stance when it comes to hormones and hormonal management, which kind of classifies in how I would describe how I was trained. So even describes about compounding pharmacies using the phrase bioidentical hormone as a marketing tool to imply that these preparations are natural and thus safer and more effective. And the FDA approved menopausal medications to use bioidentical or synthetic hormones or both. But ACOG says that evidence is lacking, so supporting marketing claims of safety and effectiveness is the thing that they're concerned by. So,
right. So a compounding pharmacy that makes say estradiol cream, right? They haven't gone through a phase 3 trial and gotten FDA approval.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily have data on, hey, here's the average serum hormone levels. This many percentage of patients gets relief of symptoms taking this hormone.
Right.
But we know that lots of people do choose to use compounding pharmacies for many reasons. Some of that, I think a very small piece of the pie is probably marketing related, but I could be wrong there. And I don't necessarily know what the general population thinks about that. But it's an interesting way to phrase it because I think the general population has become more educated on this.
Yeah.
It's become more in vogue over the past 5 years or so, I'd say, to talk about hormone replacement therapy, not just in the context of a little bit for a little while, but like
right.
Health span. So it's interesting that their stance is against bioidentical, not against compounded. It's like a kind of roundabout way of saying that compounded hormones may have some safety concerns.
Right, because it's not as regulated. And I would say like just to break down how we would use hormones in terms of the language. So bioidentical hormones, really hormones that are chemically identical, as we'd say, to those produced by the human body. Sources are often derived from plant precursors like yams and soy and synthesized to match human hormones. Examples of this are estradiol or E2, progesterone, and not medroxyprogesterone, and then micronized progesterone. And then number two would be like compounded bioidentical hormones, which is what we've been talking about. These are more custom made. I think that's where they would focus in on preparations of bioidentical hormones mixed by a compounding pharmacy that has and lacks regulations. Some examples of this are like the custom dose topical estradiol with a progesterone creams, troches pellets, sublingual tablets. Pros of this, obviously tailored dosing delivery method has some flexibility, but the cons are, of course, not FDA approved, less standardization, and then possible variation in the potency and the purity. And then two more, we've got the compounded non-bioidentical hormones. This is like the custom mixed formulations of non-bioidentical. This is what we call synthetic. It's not structurally identical to human hormones. Examples of this are how we'd say custom compounded medroxyprogesterone or ethanol estradiol. And we know that it can increase risk due to unpredictable metabolism and effects. And then the last one, commercially bioidentical hormones that are FDA approved and manufactured in standardized dosing by pharmaceutical companies. These are examples that we know as like Clymera, Estrace, Viveldot with micronized progesterone like Prometrium, and then testosterone gels and patches like the Androgel. Obviously, the pros are these are FDA regulated for purity, potency, safety, and consistency, but the cons are limited to available doses with delivery methods. So that's kind of a long spiel.
Yeah, and we can create a chart post this that kind of puts those four categories up there with some of those examples just for people to know, maybe learn what they're taking, whether they're taking bioidentical, whether they're taking something synthetic. You mentioned the Viveldot, which I really like, but I don't want to say never, but it's difficult to find pharmacies that stock it or order it. And even sometimes when I put dispenses written, they will tell the patient it's Vivel, but give them like a generic Sandoz or some other manufacturer patch. So
yeah.
What is the secret to finding where the Vivel is hidden?
That is a great question.
I've heard rumors that it's maybe not being produced, or that it like the patent transferred or it was acquired, something like that.
Yeah, I honestly don't know as well, but I'm curious to find wherever we find it. Please comment if you know where.
Yeah. People are like, I'm not going to give away my secret where I'm getting the Vivel.
It's like morel mushroom hunting. Don't give away your honey hole.
But why would you prescribe a synthetic hormone, for example?
Like, I think honestly, some of the things that we look forward in terms of evidence, you know, you say, oh my gosh, it's FDA approved, fantastic. But some of the things that I know that even other OBGYNs like to obviously take into consideration is patient autonomy and preference. I mean, hey, if you can get a cream that focuses on compounding those hormones, I mean, you use that effectively. I think that is one of the best ways that you can have a patient actually do what you would prescribe, rather than being like, hey, this is FDA approved and this is the only thing I'm going to do. So I think that there's really a risk benefit that you talk to your patients about and say, hey, here's what the lay of the land is, which I think it's important to be knowledgeable about the different types, rather than just saying, this is what I was taught, this is what I was discussed with in training. But I think at the end of the day, it comes to patient preference with knowledge that, yes, although they're not FDA approved, I think that there is enough body of evidence, whether large anecdotally, to suggest that this is still okay.
Yeah. I mean, there are some patients that hate big pharma. They hate the FDA. Maybe they hate the FDA less now. But, you know, they don't want to contribute to that system financially, and they're willing to use a compounded product. So that may be less bad, or maybe a net positive, rather than saying, okay, you don't go on any HRT and you're going to have a loss of bone density and a loss of some insulin sensitivity and some android body fat accumulation. Some of these things that are just going to happen with aging without HRT in the picture.
Right.
So I think that's a good point. And to pivot, you know, we talked about why we might prescribe compounded hormones. You know, why might you prescribe synthetic hormones? People are very afraid of synthetic hormones, I think, in the wake of the Women's Health Initiative. But just thinking in broad terms of women's health, so like birth control is one example, right?
Yeah.
Synthetic, it's a hormone, but it's extremely frequently prescribed.
Yeah.
So how do you think about that? Do you think about synthetic versus bioidentical day-to-day? And what are the most common indications for a synthetic hormone over a bioidentical?
Yeah, I mean, I think something that needs to be clarified is that bioidentical doesn't always necessarily mean natural. They're synthesized, but match human hormones, we'll say exactly. But again, they're doesn't mean that they're more beneficial. And then synthetic in kind of the opposite way is it doesn't necessarily mean evil. Some have different receptors and have different activities, higher side effect risks. So if you have like drospirenone, for example, and then you have a patient with PCOS, you would want to use something that's more anti-androgenic, whereas someone who is just trying to cope with dysmenorrhea or painful periods, ovarian cysts, that kind of thing. So I would say that it really is dependent on somewhat of the beneficial side effect profile, kind of what you're looking to gain with different types of synthetic hormones. I think that's where it has its benefit. Whereas the bioidentical doesn't necessarily have some of that tailored aspect to it.
Yeah, you can kind of capitalize on what the different medication profile is because they can sort of dial up the androgenic activity or dial down, or you can create a negative androgenic profile of some of these. And, you know, like you alluded to, controlling bleeding, right? There are synthetic progestins that are going to do that much better than just bioidentical progesterone can. So I think that's important for people not to fall into this sort of, you know, natural fallacy of like, you know, it's natural, so it must be better.
Right.
You know, air conditioning is not natural, but right now it's like 95 degrees out here. And I think air conditioning is better. So I think as natural as is reasonable is sort of the, I don't know, the phrase that kind of captures my thinking around it.
Yeah. I mean, and then you brought up the Women's Healthcare Initiative, and I think this is a really important topic in OBGYN, and I want to do it justice. But also it's just when it first came out, and there's been many people that have covered the Women's Healthcare Initiative. So I'm not trying to beat a dead horse, but I would say classically in training, it was hormones are bad in any formulation because the Women's Healthcare Initiative had said, okay, we've got decreased, we've got really downstream effects that are disadvantageous to women's health. And then looking at the study population, seeing that it was not for the first 10 years of menopause, they had done a study sample population that was not what women classically who need HRT have. So like in the perimenopause and early menopausal period, the follow-up study actually showed beneficial cognitive, bone, cardiovascular benefits. And so I think to say it's important that, especially now being a relatively new OBGYN, to not shy away from not only the use of hormones, but to be really versed on these different types. Because to say that it's to only give a certain hormone replacement therapy for a smallest amount of time, it doesn't take into consideration all the different types of formulations and different ways in which you can provide that.
Yeah. It's interesting, like the way I've sort of two patterns of thought that I have around the Women's Health Initiative. You know, one is the comparison to the use of, say, let's just take the bad things, right? The medroxyprogesterone that seemed to cause most of the problems. In treating diabetes, sulfonylureas are there, right? People can prescribe those, but they basically lead your pancreas to burning out faster in simple terms, right? They're associated with increased, you know, stroke and event rates and lots of bad things. So I could take a sulfonylurea study and say, well, we should not treat diabetes at all, or we should treat it for the shortest amount of time to relieve symptoms.
Right.
Right. And, you know, that's me being funny and saying, haha, look how ridiculous this is. But it's just an analogy for people to take another condition, chronic condition, right, and see how, okay, that line of thought doesn't track with this, so it doesn't necessarily track with the other. And the other for me is like these were synthetic hormones, right? I don't think there was a bioidentical arm. It was medroxyprogesterone and conjugated equine estrogen.
Yep.
So even though they were synthetic, there were still some benefits in certain places, you know, detriments in certain places.
Right.
Not huge detriments. But now with the bioidenticals that are available to be prescribed, commercial bioidenticals is what I tend to prescribe most of the time. I do some compounded bioidenticals, but not a huge margin of them. But it's almost like, why are people still talking about the Women's Health Initiative? Because at least the people I follow or the people that are in my circle I talk with don't prescribe medroxyprogesterone or CEE.
Right.
So, I mean, are there OBs or gynecologists out there that are still prescribing those? Or has that just largely gone away, but people are still kind of talking about the WHI because it was such a big thing?
Yeah, I mean, it truly informed, I would say, the last 20 years of, I would say, gynecologic care for menopause. So I think newer, obviously with the follow-up arm for that, that looked at what I would say the appropriate population, really we've started to adapt back to say, hey, it's not the worst thing in the world. And I think that some of the abdication in responsibility towards women that are going through this, if you're claiming to be an OBGYN, I feel like it's important to not only take care of them while they have their babies, but also take care of them in the life stage where they spend the majority of their time as well, which is in that menopausal period. And so just to say I don't prescribe hormones, I think that's kind of a cop-out. And again, that might be a little bit more, we'll say, how would you say, probably controversial. But I think it's important that we take care of the whole patient. And I think that just saying that I'm going to only stick with this one aspect because that's how I've been trained is I feel like a disservice. So that's why I'm personally trying to really dig deep in hormones. And you guys at Gillette Health are amazing at being able to not only tailor your treatment towards your patients, but you just have an incredible wealth of knowledge. So yeah, it's going to be fun to learn.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the kind words. And I think, yeah, certain people are going to limit their scope in certain areas, right? I don't really see pediatrics, even though my degree says I can see pediatrics because I feel right. like, you know, if I focus on fewer things, I'll be better at those things. Like, you know, the jack of all trades, but master of none. And there's great people that see kids and adults. I'm just not one of those people that sees people across the lifespan, including childhood. Adults tend to be a little bit more rational and better historians. That's right. My defense. But there is great people in this office that I can refer if children want to be seen, right? I've got Dr. Mark Gillette, Amanda Morris, another nurse practitioner. So I think if you're a provider that's in a hormone specialty, I'm just going to call OB-GYN that. It's kind of like, where else are women going to go for hormones? Probably not an endocrinologist. Then they should at least have someone's like, oh, hey, I don't do hormones, but Dan Bristow does. Let me send you to him. He's a great guy. That way the patient isn't sort of like, well, you know, this is me now. And one more little jab I'll throw at ACOG, then we can move on from that topic, is why are they worried about the safety and efficacy and absorption and metabolism of compounded hormones if most like traditional OB-GYNs aren't checking serum levels anyway?
I honestly think that with the, I guess, the how we would describe when we would use hormones, it would be based off symptom management. So is it going to change how I prescribe if I'm, you know, just going off symptoms? Hey, I'm going to give you the smallest dose. You come back in a couple months and see how have your symptoms changed. If you're still having hot flashes, mood swings, then we go up in your dose. So I think with that, it's a little bit more of a cop-out because do you want to ask questions about testosterone that we necessarily don't want to? Because if you are a classic OBGYN, you would say based off of this, testosterone is not something that we would want to prescribe. So I really think it's more in the gray area where we would kind of discuss, particularly with ACOG, if you were strict by the book ACOG prescriber, this would be difficult for you. That's why I think it's important to, like you said, have colleagues that have knowledge in multiple aspects. And I think even if we consider that, like, yes, this is the base in America, I mean, but we have so many different other countries that have our leaps and bounds in how they treat women in the menopausal period. And I mean, I think that's one of the benefits of just research banks that we can look at and say, oh, well, the study in Sweden said this, or the study in India said this. And so I think it's important that we shouldn't just throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think it's important to take a look holistically.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. You know, if someone is, you know, has a network and like people that are like lifelong learners like yourself, right? Maybe some people are sunsetting their careers and they're not interested in picking up a new sort of specialty or subspecialty within their specialty, then yeah, just having someone to refer to, it's pretty simple. And I mean, measuring serum hormone levels, I don't know if it's like the single biggest thing that would change menopause management, but it's up there, right? If you look at maybe a sevenfold difference, some studies, and like how a patch absorbs in one woman versus the other. Like,
right.
I don't know if you've seen this, but I like commonly the very highest dose of the estradiol patch, 0.1 milligram, I'm not seeing a serum level that gets up to above 40. And according to the package insert, it should be higher than that. But I'm seeing women where it's not, right? So people have different skin permeability. And I think that's like a big takeaway is if someone is managing hormones, like serum levels, it's a no-brainer to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's – what's so funny is, like, as recently getting out of training, we talk about reference ranges that I still need to memorize because we don't use them very often because you're like, all right, you've got symptoms, give you this, see you back.
It sounds like psychiatry.
So
is ACOG a psychiatric?
Well, no. you'd be shocked at the amount of psychiatric prompts and topics we cover in OBGYN.
That's probably a good thing, though. Like, you know, that may be the provider the woman's the most comfortable with, has the best rapport with.
And well, a lot of women would, I wouldn't say a lot of women, but some women would only visit their OBGYN. And so it's important to do, like if you're doing a physical exam, check the thyroid and things that you wouldn't necessarily say that you would do as a OBGYN. But if women only come to you and they don't, say, come to a family med doc, this is kind of where you said, like, what do you choose to give your patients or what do you choose to specialize in that it's going to be in maximal benefit for your patient? Because even though I could potentially diagnose a thyroid cancer, obviously it would be more of like, oh, I feel a nodule there. I'm going to send it off. Even as we would think, even for like breast exams, I mean, I'm instructed to know what a breast nodule feels like and what is normal and abnormal. Am I a breast surgeon? No, but that's why I would say let's refer to one of the breast surgeons in town, and then we kind of talk about it and discuss. So
now pivoting over into, I guess, or diving deeper into like the functional side of like women's health and hormones, I think compounded preparations are probably more used in practices that brand themselves as functional medicine. People have to be careful with that because sometimes there is a financial incentive to prescribe you know, compounded versus commercial. So that's just sort of a tidbit. If your prescriber won't send hormones where you want them to be sent, like if you want to get a patch from CVS, and they're like, no, I'll send you this compounded thing. Yeah, maybe that's just a yellow flag because they're not comfortable with anything outside of compounded, but it's a flag, right? Something like that. So beta-glucuronidase, this is something that, you know, I hear mentioned in hormone health, right? It's all over, you know, Instagram. I'm not really on TikTok, but I assume it's on TikTok as well now. So what is beta-glucuronidase and, you know, why does it matter for hormone health?
Yeah, that's a good question. And honestly, like even before we had talked about this, I started to try to go into a deeper dive because a lot of what we're starting to realize about the gut microbiota really can affect how hormones and even hormone management, as we were talking earlier, it can really play into it. So if you, this is like going back to med school and it's like pulling teeth, but your liver has a certain job in that if there's too many hormones, long story short, it can tag a little, like make it into a different, so let's say steroid hormone goes into a glucuronic acid. It can tag it, and then it's tagged for excretion. So in the gut, there is beta-glucuronidase, which is a enzyme that basically deconjugates these hormones. So if you're looking at testosterone and estrogen, we'll mainly focus on estrogen. These deconjugated estrogens that the liver has glucuronidated, those can be reabsorbed. And so thinking about how that works for, I would say, OBGYN pathology, if you have a high enough amount of beta-glucuronidase, say that there are, and we know different types of bacterial microbiota make them in higher amounts, they would essentially increase the amount of circulated estrogen in a way that the liver might not be able to keep up with. And so increasing risk for breast cancer, endometrial cancer, worsening PCOS, maybe even having some resistance to things like endometriosis, medical management. So as we talked about synthetic hormones, putting someone on a synthetic hormone to help with those symptoms or even like disease progression, we'll say, in endometriosis, this beta-glucuronidase research has kind of come up to say, well, maybe there's a link between those two.
Yeah. And is this something that's like popular enough where patients are coming in and like asking you to test this, or they're mentioning this term to you, or it's not there yet?
I don't think it's there yet.
Okay.
No, I think this is kind of on the forefront of
more like academically people are interested in it.
Yeah. And I think even like precision medicine in looking at stool samples and stuff, seeing, okay, well, we know the beta-glucuronidase maybe plays a factor, but it's hard to figure out in this space whether correlation or causation is there. Because although, and I'd looked at a study, there's a, I'll just read it, case control study measuring beta-glucuronidase in stool from women with PCOS, there was significantly higher beta-glucuronidase levels in PCOS patients. Beta-glucosidase activity was also higher, and essentially saying if you have higher levels of beta-glucuronidase, then you would have higher levels of circulating estrogen, which would, like I said, further contribute to this pathological process. So observations suggest that the gut enzyme activity may contribute to the hormonal milieu of PCOS. So I think that that's something to be explored further. And I don't think it's really hit any mainstream yet, we'll say, especially in OBGYN.
Yeah, I like the way you described it as sort of, you know, the liver is tagging these things for elimination, right? Hormones, right? Saying, hey, you know, we have a, you know, it's sort of an extra feedback mechanism. You've got your pituitary and the liver is sort of regulating, making sure things are flowing out at a steady rate so they don't just build up and then, you know, have a flood of hormones there. But if I can do my very best Dr. Kyle Gillette impression here, I'm going to create an analogy.
He's
an analogy enthusiast. So the liver is like the family that goes into a hoarder's home. And they're tagging things. They say, you've got to throw this out. You've got to throw this out. You've got to throw this out. We've got to get rid of this. And the hoarder is beta-glucuronidase. And it's going, and after the family has left, it's untagging these and saying, well, I need to keep this. So it just builds up and builds up and builds up, and it's overwhelming. Is that a fair analogy?
I like it. It's what's interesting is that does the liver or those who tag it for removal from the house, can it keep up with the hypervigilant individual that's saying, no, I want to keep that, and I want to keep that? It's hard to tell, and that's where we're, I think, I'm excited about some of the research with it. Definitely, I would consider, like, looking at beta-glucuronidase in the stool, because there's a couple ways, and as I've been researching, like, beta-glucuronidase can be decreased, and that's essentially knocking down levels, whether it's, if we know that certain bacteria...
So you decrease beta-glucuronidase, you're going to decrease total hormone exposure. Is that the correct line of thinking
that's
for people who want to...
Essentially what it looks like. But again, it's hard to tell like chicken or the egg, because if we know there's looking at menopause, it says after menopause, women show reduced gut microbial diversity and lower beta-glucuronidase activity. Long-term estrogen supplementation actually decreases fecal beta-glucuronidase activity and correlates with higher lactobacilli abundance. So it's hard to say like what exactly comes first or maybe what's evident in the pathology is to start. But I think it's, I don't know, it's going to be something that I might look at to say, all right, well, maybe if we have some resistant type of PCOS or endometriosis that you're still having symptoms, I mean, then we'll just throw paint at a wall and see what sticks. I mean, I might send off a stool beta-glucuronidase assay and kind of say, well, is there something to this? Maybe let's talk about increasing your fiber, increasing your activity and exercise, which we know is one of the first-line treatments for PCOS, for example, is kind of those lifestyle modifications.
Yeah. So aside from, you know, fiber and exercise and, you know, certain supplements, I guess, what are the levers that could potentially be pulled on for someone who, say, they're eating a good amount of fiber, which... by my definition is, you know, more than 35 grams per day and getting there slowly. If somebody watches this and they eat no fiber and then they go try to eat 35 grams, they're not going to like me. They're going to say that guy tried to kill me. but what someone's exercising, they're eating a good amount of fiber. Are there additional levers to try to lower that beta-glucuronidase?
Yeah. And this is something I still need to look more into, but essentially changing the gut microbiota, so pre and probiotics, have been described as a possible lever that can be pulled. that we can say, well, maybe you can alter the amount of beta-glucuronidase secreting or, I guess, involving bacteria that you have in your gut, and then we can see how that works. So I think that the changes to diet, even though that we know what we'll say is an endpoint, maybe all of these like microenzymatic changes we haven't necessarily explored and identified until, you know, as science gets further progressed. And so I think that's one of the cool things. Could this be the linchpin? We don't know.
Yeah, my intuition is that the bulk of it is going to be lifestyle modification, but it would be interesting if there is a highly selective like beta-glucuronidase inhibitor, right, that comes on the market and you basically eliminate it as a variable. Is that a good thing? And now are you flushing out hormones too quickly?
Right.
I don't know, but it would kind of answer some of the questions here about, oh, that's like everything that this specific enzyme is involved in.
Right. And then, I mean, even I guess as more of like the, we'll say like as my study, so you like have knockouts for genes associated with beta-glucuronidase, and then maybe they really explore their diet and make sure that there's, I don't know, maybe they test their stool samples and figure out which type they of microbiota they have and try to like really knock down those variables. I think we'll have a better idea, but I don't know. I'm just spitballing. I'm not exactly sure where this will lead, but I came across it. And like you said, it's been kind of in the media lately. So especially as it relates to OBGYN, really thinking about this for my PCOS patients who come in and they're just ticked because, hey, doc, I've gone through the lifestyle changes. I'm still having these issues. I don't necessarily want to be on an oral contraceptive pill. I don't want to be on spironolactone. And then patients that have recurrent endometriosis. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we can also talk about with fertility and fertility management with that, that beta-glucuronidase seems to affect. So I think this is more of a question that needs further answering and research, but definitely something to be explored further, yeah.
Yeah, and on the PCOS, like in my thinking, PCOS, the symptoms are primarily androgen-driven. So is it the beta-glucuronidase? Like you probably see, you know, higher levels of estrogen if there's higher beta-glucuronidase in this PCOS subtypes that have this issue with beta-glucuronidase.
Yeah.
But is it the circulating androgens that are also not being metabolized as efficiently that are contributing to some of that problem?
Yeah. I mean, I think you hit it on the head. Looking more of this with PCOS patients, there was classically associated with androgen excess, like you said, and insulin resistance. But there's also disturbed estrogen metabolism that might also play a role. And there's a study that showed that women with PCOS had higher fetal beta-glucuronidase, as I said earlier, activity, and this activity correlated with estradiol and testosterone levels. Mm. There's a rodent study that cited by the authors that found that gut bacterial beta-glucuronidase can alter androgen metabolism via de-glucuronidation. So,
yeah,
possibly.
It's interesting. It'd be very interesting if you could somehow manipulate the gut bacteria to decrease like the paracrine androgenic activity in the skin, right? So common presentations I think of, you know, the PCOS, if they don't want to take anti-androgenic medications, you know, usually it's oily skin, acne, you know, hair thinning, you know, and of course the metabolic health and body composition that they are going to have an uphill battle with. Doesn't mean it's impossible to do
right.
with lifestyle, but if you could alter at least that paracrine activity in the skin of like testosterone to DHT, then like that would be a really like important thing to do, like as a positive intervention for these people. Like, you know, not everyone is a good candidate. I'd argue that there's probably very few people that are good candidates for a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor.
Mm.
You know, these, you know, younger women of childbearing age, and you know, if you're putting them on a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, typically it's best practice to also put them on a birth control and
right.
oral contraceptive. So then it's like, well, the oral contraceptive is going to solve the problem and you don't actually need the finasteride, dutasteride, whatever it may be.
Right.
So it's a tricky situation. And there are some people who are like mature and very health literate and understand what they need to do to prevent like teratogenic effects. But yeah, if we could start doing things with the gut microbiome to like affect these outcomes, right? I think that would be really interesting, because if it's just sort of pulling the body's natural levers, I feel right? I don't have evidence for this, but I feel like it would have a better side effect profile.
Mm. So you're saying natural is better.
Yeah, I'm falling for the natural fallacy.
Okay, got
That's
it.
Right.
Got it.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, and really for, I even think about my endometriosis patients. There was a study in 2023 that showed that beta-glucuronidase expression was higher in endometriotic lesions than in normal endometrium. Enzyme promoted proliferation and migration of endometrial stromal cells. Adenomyosis, which is essentially where the endometriotic, we'll say, implants actually burrow into the myometrium, causing pain. Essentially, it's almost like a type of endometriosis, where endometriosis is actually like little implants of the endometrium that spread out through usually the peritoneal cavity. I think that this might be something that it would be, obviously, further study would be warranted, because, I mean, there is some aspect, we'll say, correlational, causational, don't know. Like I said, maybe it's linchpin, I doubt it, but I think it's something that it needs its attention to.
Yeah, it's exciting stuff for me and for yourself and anyone who's interested in this and, you know, women's health and hormones. I have, I guess, one final, you know, question that I've heard this by multiple of my female patients have came and said this now. You know, it doesn't matter if they have endometriosis or if they have, you know, fibroids, or, you know, like you're describing, you know, where the endometrial tissue grows into the uterus, the adenomyosis, is that how you say it?
Yeah.
I always butcher that one. But they're told by their OBGYNs that, oh, well, fortunately, you don't have to worry about this much longer because it goes away once you enter menopause. So on one hand, I understand that, right? These are thought to be estrogen-dependent conditions. And if estrogen goes away, then, yeah, symptoms are probably going to be maybe not zero, but significantly less. Does that still apply for women that are on hormone replacement therapy?
Yeah, good question. I think it would probably be something that I would look more into before I truly went into the depth of it. But just from patient experiences, I would say that classically, menopause alleviates a lot of those, what we'll say, estrogen-dependent processes, fibroids, adenomyosis. A lot of times we find shrinking of those over time because of that. Now, if a patient is on HRT, you obviously have those receptors that obviously still can have estrogen that would cause it to grow. But what we know more so now is that it's the cycle of the estrogen and progesterone that can really cause it to grow. So having a kind of a stable level, I think, would be not as, we'll say, detrimental to if someone says, I really want these fibroids to slow down or decrease. That would be something I would do, is place them on, like, obviously, continued. But at the end of the day, we have to figure what's your, what do you want? Because as OBGYNs, it's easy to say, well, you could take out your uterus. And that's a viable way to, the only way you can actually diagnose adenomyosis, and MRIs are better now, but is with tissue pathology that you would get via hysterectomy. So I think that there is a really good benefit for certain patients to do surgery. And hey, I love operating. It's not my go-to, because I like to try everything before I try the most invasive thing. But I think that at the end of the day, it's going to be what is going to best alleviate symptoms in my mind. And if we've tried all those things and resistance, why not take out the organ that is causing the problem? But hot take.
Yeah. Yeah. Something for people to, you know, prepare for and think about. And maybe it's not the very first thing, but someone comes in with some heavier bleeding, you know, like, oh yeah, just take it out. Like, no, that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about sort of
insurance would be like, yeah, I'm going to laugh at you.
Yeah. You're going to sort of run the gamut of like, what's the highest likelihood with the least downsides of solving this problem without, you know, causing, you know, major bodily trauma. Right. Surgery is a trauma, even if it's a positive outcome long term. And I like the way that, you know, you sort of think about this, like, and the way that I sort of have a similar approach, thinking of like menopausal hormone replacement therapy, it is different than your naturally fluctuating hormones as a woman when you're 30 or 40 or 50, depending on when you make that transition. You're in menopause. I mean, if I'm prescribing your therapy, you're probably not going to be peaking at a 300 or 400 estradiol every single month. So maybe the lack of that cyclical component, where it's kind of typically a lower serum level than when you're 20, and then you have your, you know, progesterone in there consistently, or you know, there's other ways to control the endometrial proliferation.
Yeah.
But you're probably getting less area under the curve exposure to estrogen total and less fluctuations, right? So if you are, you know, ramping up to 300, 400, and we think about the tissue, and maybe it's overexpressing receptors, or it's getting sort of like recycled. Somehow it's getting an amplified signal in that like endometrial tissue that's outside the uterus, not where it's supposed to be.
Right.
Then that 300 becomes a lot more than 300 as far as the tissue action. Whereas if you're, you know, serum level of 50 and your bones are keeping their mass, you feel great, you're killing your workouts, your insulin's going down, then maybe you don't have a problem with your endometriosis at a level 50, but you do when you're spiking to 300 every single month.
Yeah.
So I think we sort of thought about that the same way, even though, you know, I don't know beyond a shadow of a doubt that that's the case. I can just speculate. And maybe these people know something that I don't, and you know, just magically whenever you haven't had a period for 12 months, then all these symptoms go away.
But yeah.
I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah. No, one of the things that I had thought about when you were talking was, we put patients on like an oral contraceptive for recurrent ovarian cysts. And I remember specifically this one lady who was 30 and already had one ovary out because there was just a recurrent cyst formation, one led to torsion. And at the time, and we know enough to know now that like even if the ovary looks necrotic or dead, you actually should recommend detorsing it and then leaving it in there. And so and the ovary is very resilient to being able to reestablish blood flow. But to put a woman on OCPs, it's more so to have that, and we usually do continuous because we don't want to have those spikes that lead to follicular development and then just some people's inclination to growing massive cysts and then obviously having the issues with that, whether it's rupture, whether it's torsion. So I think that there's benefits to having a really just to manipulate the gonadal axis to say, okay, well, we don't really want to spike our FSH and LH to the point that it's going to cause this massive cyst. So we're gonna give you some hormones. So in the same way that like HRT, I still think would be really beneficial for patients to say that have fibroids or adenomyosis or something that I don't think would necessarily cause those things to grow because you just have a stable but smaller amount over time than what your body had produced. That would still obviously help you with your symptoms, vasomotor symptoms, for example. So I kind of think of that the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, you're manipulating this stimulus on the tissue. So like the FSH, the development of the follicles, right? You decrease the input, you're going to decrease that risk of that growth. Same thing with decreasing the estrogen exposure for the endometrial tissue and endometriosis where it's not supposed to be. So I guess it's a similar way to think about two very different conditions, but are still under that umbrella of, you know, a women's health or hormonal or, you know, estrogen related, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this has been a really, you know, good conversation. Hopefully people understand, you know, bioidentical you can get from like a CVS or a Walgreens, a big box pharmacy. You can also get them compounded. I would argue it's a little bit trickier because the reliability and the serum levels, there may be a little bit of batch-to-batch variation. We don't know exactly how they're going to absorb, whereas I have a ballpark idea with, you know, the commercials, but we're still going to check the levels. So I think serum testing is big, and we can put like a little ding for that one, so it gets people's attention.
So you're like, if you're not going to go with, we'll say, FDA approved, and you want to go with combined, that would really be beneficial where you would say, okay, what's your hormone level? Whereas if you were classic OBGYN going to treat for the smallest amount of time, the smallest dose, then maybe you don't need to really go out and do testing every 2 to 3 months or when you come back, because that's kind of not where you're playing. But if you're playing into the combined, and maybe there's benefit there. I mean, I really think so, because like you said, there could be different formulations and, you know, it's harder to tailor that if you don't have the ability to measure it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the measurement is like, we can't measure tissue levels yet, like, and especially in different tissues, like, okay, that serum level of what means this is happening in the brain or this is happening in the bones. Like some of those things I think are mapped out a little bit. Like, you know, you go higher, like very small amounts of replacement relieve the vasomotor symptoms. Like a little bit more seems to be good for the bone health. Like a little bit more seems to have maybe some endothelial benefits. And then like a little bit more, that's where maybe there's a positive signal for brain health. Like I can pretty confidently say it doesn't harm cognition, but I can't say that like HRT is going to prevent your dementia. Like I think that's a misleading claim.
Yeah.
You know, if you squint really hard at some of the data and E4, like APOE4 carriers, like there might be a signal of like some beneficial things happening there, but that's not like all of the population. It's actually a minority of the population.
Right.
So,
yeah. I mean, and also if you have, I'll use the, VOS is the actual name of it, but fezolinetant is the drug. It's a selective neurokinin 3 receptor. They call it works on like the KNDY or KND neurons in the hypothalamus to treat vasomotor symptoms for patients that can't take HRT, whether they've got a blood clot issue, cardiovascular disease, that the cardiologist is like, whoa, which actually there has been some more move towards use of, say, vaginal estrogen, patients that have had some hematologic malignancies. They're actually looking more to say that vaginal estrogen is really like 1/100th of a dose. And we haven't even talked about general urinary symptoms of menopause. This is really just more so the HRT component focused on vasomotor symptoms. But that's a really big switch too in how different specialties look at different risk, you know, because, you know, the analogy of the cardiologist hating the kidney docs because there's just this antagonistic relationship.
Just get more Lasix.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, why not? So I think that there's some there.
Yeah, I think those are important options for people to be aware of. I mean, if someone is like suffering and they're told they're not a candidate for HRT, like there are other things that are out there. I would argue like the VEOZAH is miles ahead of like paroxetine in terms of controlling symptoms, but your insurance might want you to try paroxetine first.
You know,
have to play the game and jump through the hoops and that sort of thing. And then vaginal estrogen, I think as we're sitting here right now, they're talking about maybe removing the black box warning from that with like breast cancer and so forth.
I haven't heard that, but that would be wonderful.
It's on the vaginal estrogen, but
I get that like question every single time.
1 to maybe 3 picograms per mL is what it actually raises serum levels. Like it's seems like it's enough where a lot of oncologists are like, oh yeah, it's not systemic, right? Technically, it's a little systemic, but for like outcomes purposes, it's not systemic enough to matter.
Right, and obviously there's DHEA that you can give as a cream, and so there's different ways in which you can get around patients who can't tolerate or take HRT. And I'm by no means the expert in a lot of this, but I'm really just interested in it. And so as I gain more knowledge, I'm sure I'll look back at this and I'll be like, oh, what did you just say? I think it's a really, I will say, hot topic, but with that, with beta-glucuronidase, with how ACOG views combined hormonal or combined HRT, and I think it's a rolling conversation with our patients, and
And maybe I was a little hard on, you know, ACOG. I don't hate ACOG. I think that having guidelines in general is a good thing. You know, it gives people a starting place, like some guardrails of like what do you do to like not hurt somebody or to like help with certain conditions, and you know, it's a reasonable starting place. And I think I'll borrow a Dr. Gillette analogy. You know, if you're going to go outside of the guidelines, like if you're going to drive your car fast, then you should be a skilled driver, I think is how he describes it. So
it's a good one.
Lifelong learning, education, talking with, you know, intelligent colleagues like yourself. That's a big part of what we do. So, it's, you know, having a good network, and we're happy to have you as part of that and learn from you, share cases back and forth. So, you know, this has been a lot of fun for me. I hope it was fun for you also.
Yeah, it was a blast.
And, I hope our audience gets some valuable takeaways from this. So, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, heck yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yep. And if people want to find you, how can they do that?
I honestly don't have much of a social media presence yet, so I'll be working at a hospital here shortly as a kind of a transition from residency. So always accepting new patients up at Mosaic Care in St. Joe. So I'm happy and excited to start there.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. We'll put that in the description for people. As always, thank you for watching, and may God bless you with health and happiness.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store and online. And now, the more you buy, the more you save on beds, bases, and more. Limited time. For J.D. Power 2025 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Check it out at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com today.